everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, the podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is special guest Jake Rubin, the founder and CEO of Hapdex. Hello, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And of course, beaming in from Germany, we have Mr. Peter Leckoff.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. So today we're going to be talking a lot about haptic feedback, about hands in VR, about tracking hands and fingers and joints, all the intricate details of the complexities of what comes with hands and what comes with actually trying to simulate haptic feedback. So Jake, I think you're probably one of the leading experts in this field, as far as we can tell. And the product that you guys are working on is probably one of the most advanced forms of haptic gloves that we have tried, or at least that I have tried. And I guess as a full disclosure, I did work with you guys on your last trailer, on your last like mixed reality commercial that you built. But this podcast was not really a part of that. This is just us talking about the technology, and just because this is exactly the type of conversations that we like to have on the podcast. So just wanted to put that out there. So Jake, how did you find yourself in this virtual reality industry? Like, what led you to come here? Did you come here from the more research perspective, or did you always want to work on VR gloves?
Yeah, you know, I've really been fascinated by VR as long as I can remember. I mean, at least since since high school, I've been, you know, working on and thinking a lot about this concept of, you know, of how we immerse people in a virtual world. And pretty early on, I zeroed in on haptics. And, you know, even back then, that was before the Oculus Rift Kickstarter, before, you know, VR got hot again, really during the tail end of the long VR winter. And even back then, you know, digging into the academic literature and patent filings and looking at the activity in the field, it seemed to me that one of the most interesting and urgent problems to solve was haptics. You know, how do we get the rest of our bodies in the VR experience? Even back then, it was pretty clear that the audiovisual piece, although it wasn't there yet, was going to be solved, and that most of the basic science was at least fairly mature. And the same was not true for haptics. So that's really what led me to zero in very early on haptics.
Mm. And I believe the earlier forms of, you know, VR headsets, especially in research, in the research labs, had some form of gloves that had these, I think, like metal like tips at the fingers that you could use as input methods. But were they doing some sort of hand tracking, or was that just a kind of a binary input that they've used? Do you know what I'm kind of referring to?
Yeah. So, I mean, there have been data gloves or haptic gloves in various forms since, certainly since the early 80s. And a lot of the foundation of haptics dates to that period. Of course, back then, the technology wasn't really mature enough to give a very good experience, just like with headsets. But a lot of what you'll see in today's haptic devices, particularly the sort of consumer-grade haptic devices that aren't as much on the cutting edge of haptic feedback and haptic technology, is very similar feedback methods to what you would have found in those gloves in the late 80s or early 90s. Of course, they're a lot less expensive, and they're they're more elegantly packaged today. But the basics of, for example, vibrotactile feedback using vibrating motors, or force feedback, applying small forces on the fingers, hasn't really changed a lot in most gloves and other haptic peripherals since that period.
Mm. And so I guess you've really had to work on your own technology. You had to figure out how to create haptic feedback on your hands. I know we've talked a little bit about haptics before, but there's different forms of feeling things, right? There's you can probably explain this better than I can, but in terms of like that, you can feel texture, you can feel force, you can feel heat, or like what are the different kind of dimensions that you can concentrate across? And I guess which ones have you found to be the most useful to build for, or like which ones are the most achievable? If you can give us the landscape of like what exists and what really needs work on, and which side of haptics you guys are concentrating on.
Yeah, so, you know, with haptics, as with any field that deals with human perception, it's really important to understand the physiological and psychological basis of, you know, of human perception before you go in and start trying to develop technology. Because, of course, you know, everything is interfacing with the human. And ultimately, it's the human perception that's going to be the determining factor in, you know, in the design of the system. And so, you know, we think of haptics as falling into four fundamentally different categories. And I actually wrote a series of blog posts on this, I think about a year and a half ago. It's a bit outdated as far as our technology goes, but it does a pretty good job of covering these four basic categories. So quick plug, if anyone listening is interested in more details, you can find that on our blog. But the first category is force feedback. And this is what gives you a sense of sort of kinesthetic perception, where your body is in space, and gross forces acting on your body. So, for example, talking about the hands, you know, resistance on your fingers as you grab something rigid. And that comes from a series of receptors spread throughout your muscles and your ligaments. The second category of feedback is we call tactile feedback. And tactile feedback is relatively low frequency, high displacement stimulation of the skin. So this is a dominant piece of haptic perception, particularly at the hands for sort of dexterous you know, motor skills and interactions. And there's a couple of different classes of receptors in your skin that that correspond to this type of feedback. So with tactile feedback, you have very high spatial acuity. So for example, if you touch an edge or a corner of something, you can feel, you know, the precise shape. That all comes from this mechanism of feedback, which really comes down to the deformation of the skin. And because this is responsive to lower frequency and higher displacement, this really has to do with the deformation of your skin. There's another type of tactile feedback that we call vibrotactile feedback, which corresponds to a different set of receptors in your skin. And vibrotactile feedback is how we feel fine textures. So there's a type of receptor buried deep in your skin called the Purkinje corpuscle, and it's got very low spatial acuity. So the receptive fields for these receptors are very large, but they're incredibly sensitive to high frequencies. So for example, if you run your finger across like a table, these receptors are what let you know that there's a sort of a wood grain in that table. And then lastly, there's thermal feedback. And thermal feedback is, of course, what lets you know if something is hot or cold. But it also is responsible for more subtle types of sensation related to material properties that come down to the heat flux between your hand and an object. So, for example, a block of metal and a block of wood at the same temperature will feel different because they're pulling different amounts of heat out of your skin.
Yeah, that difference is what you feel to be thermal, right? Like thermal haptic. It's all about that heat transfer, and how fast something transfers makes you think about the metallic nature of that like material.
Exactly. And most thermal haptics today has been pretty basic. It deals with essentially hot and cold. But there are more subtle models, including a prototype that we built and demonstrated about a year and a half ago, that do actually accurately model the heat flux through materials. So that will capture those material properties as well as just the hot and cold, the absolute temperature of an object.
And what is the resolution of the thermal perception? So could you actually distinguish if something is a block of wood and has a small metal piece on top of it? Or
so the as we kind of found out the hard way, the resolution is very poor. So when we built that prototype, which I'm not sure if you guys had a chance to try, it was
I did actually, maybe about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, that big sort of refrigerator-sized box we built.
Yeah, I actually tried it too back at the office in San Francisco where I visited Azad.
Yeah, so that had actually 22 independent zones that we could heat or cool very quickly. And we were using a fluid-based thermal feedback approach. So the level of heat flux we could achieve was very, very high. And that system turned out to be overkill in almost every way. We overshot quite a bit on the resolution and found that we could turn at least half of the channels off and people wouldn't notice. So your spatial resolution, and again, you know, we built that based on the academic literature, so we already knew that thermal perception was poor as far as spatial resolution. We found it was even worse than we had thought. So you really can only distinguish, you know, a handful of independent thermal zones in a given area of your skin. So for example, there's no real reason to have more than one thermal zone per fingertip, and there's no reason to have more than a handful for your palm because you just can't distinguish individual zones. There are some interesting illusions that will develop if you pack alternating temperature zones more tightly than you can individually distinguish them. So there's one that's pretty well known in the haptic community called the thermal grill illusion. And that's if you basically alternate in a checkerboard or a lattice pattern areas of hot and cold. And essentially it confuses your brain to the point where you perceive that as pain. And that's something that, you know, we had a mode on our system where we could, you know, we could turn on that thermal grill illusion. And it's both, you know, it's both a bit terrifying because it's a very intense sensation. And it's very susceptible to visual suggestion because it's a confusing sensation that you really wouldn't feel in any real world interaction typically. And so, you know, we found that if we showed a sharp object touching the person's hand, they would interpret it as pain. If we showed a hot object touching the person's hand, they would interpret it as burning. And if we showed a really cold object, like a block of ice touching their hand, they would interpret it as like freezing or frostbite. So certainly an unpleasant unpleasant perception, but very susceptible to suggestion.
With all of those being the same input, with just a different visual stimulus?
Exactly. So that really shows, you know, two things. One, the importance of, you know, the human psychology and the perception of touch. And two, the importance of the visual and haptic interaction. You know, we've seen that, you know, multimodal interaction. So both within haptics. So for example, having force and tactile and vibration and thermal sensations all working together. And outside of haptic perception, having those accurately tied into the visual and the auditory perceptions is absolutely critical for immersion. And when you're, you know, missing some of those key channels of input, or when they clash with other forms of input, your brain gets a little bit confused. And it throws off your ability to interact in the environment. It can cause mild forms of simulator sickness. It can cause a haptic version of sort of the uncanny valley, where you know you feel like there's something wrong and you just can't put your finger on it. So we found it's critically important to have multiple modes of sensation that are all synchronized in a proper way for your brain to accept the fact that you are, you know, touching a real object.
Actually describing very nicely the concept of sensory motor integration and multi-sensory integration, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, science has been devoted since, particularly cognitive science, since I think 10, 15 years, very strongly to finding out those patterns in the brain, so the areas of the brain that actually do the integration between different sensational and also sensory so like motor and sensational information. And it's kind of amazing that you figure it out basically not by looking at the brain, but by kind of, you know, trying out how to hack this whole system. It's kind of like a visual illusion, but more from different perspective or from a different perception. Very interesting.
As an engineering company trying to build a practical product, and this is not, doesn't just apply to us, but to basically every, you know, everyone in the VR community, you know, we don't have the luxury of doing years of in-depth research on human perception. You know, there's no question that the most efficient way to trick the brain is to have a deep, deep understanding of, you know, the neurological and psychological bases of perception. But that's just not fully understood so far, especially for haptic perception. And so, you know, for us, we have to fall back on really the more physical and physiological bases for perception. So, you know, for us, when we think about tactile feedback, which is kind of, you know, our specialty, our 130 points of, you know, high displacement, microfluidic tactile feedback, really one of the biggest things that differentiates us from any other product out there. You know, when we think about that feedback, we ultimately are trying to deform the skin physically the same way it would be if you touched a virtual object, because that is the best, most reliable way to guarantee that you're going to get a realistic sensation. We just don't know enough about what's happening, you know, under the skin in the, you know, in the nervous system to, you know, take advantage of some of those you know, those physiological and psychological bases of perception to make that that sensation better. And, you know, when we can take advantage of illusions, like, for example, the thermal grill illusion, to produce better sensations, we absolutely will do that. And we found, you know, a few times we've been pleasantly surprised where, you know, particularly if you have good multimodal sensory integration. So if you have force feedback and tactile feedback and visual and audio all working together, the brain can be a little bit more forgiving of issues in the fidelity of any one of those channels. But if they're not properly synchronized or if one of them is missing, like for example, if you just don't have tactile feedback, you don't have force feedback, it tends to be profoundly uncanny. So, you know, and this kind of segues a little bit from the basic science into, you know, why we've chosen to design our product the way we have. You know, obviously our product is a very high-end, you know, relatively complex product. And, you know, early on we did extensive testing on various combinations of features, different densities of tactile actuators, different levels of, you know, quality in our controller, you know, for example, different numbers of steps that we can inflate our actuators in, different amounts of displacement, different combinations of force feedback and tactile feedback and vibration feedback, thermal feedback. And we really found in that process that, you know, the bare minimum from our perspective to get the level of fidelity and realism that our customers in the enterprise space require was to have high quality tactile feedback, force feedback, and very accurate motion tracking. We found that go ahead.
Maybe before we go so much into the detail, maybe we should describe at least one or two example scenes. How would it basically feel like? Because when I tried it first time in this big refrigerator, it was kind of mind blowing for me because one of the demos that I remember was like a deer running on my hand, and it was also like a hot, or it was like flame from dragon. Also a cold cannon in my hands that I would actually feel, and it blew literally my mind because we had in a podcast previously Tesla Suit, which is more like, you know, it's doing haptics through electrostimulation, and it is whole body suit, sure, but you don't have this force that actually presses against your finger. And maybe we should also kind of explain how, or you should maybe go more into detail how exactly the glove works. So I mean, all the fluids going through the capillaries, right? So how exactly does it actually work?
Yeah. So the way our glove works, the core aspect of the glove is a microfluidic smart textile we've developed. So it's a silicone-based material that essentially has many tiny embedded capillaries and little micro pneumatic actuators, which are kind of like high-tech bubbles. And we can pack those very densely in thin, flexible arrays that we then can integrate with fabrics. So as a result, we can put, you know, for example, our current glove has 130 actuators within the glove, and we can, you know, put even more than that in the glove in the future. We can scale this to the entire body. It really is a sort of a general purpose haptic display in a thin, flexible form factor.
And each of them can be hot, cold, strongly inflated or not so strongly inflated, and each of them has, I guess, a separate canal or like a separate line of fluid coming in and out, right?
Yeah. So one important thing to clarify is in our current development kit glove, there is no thermal feedback. So we decided to leave that till a future release. Just given that, you know, for most of our customers, that's a nice to have feature, not an essential feature. We want to focus, you know, sort of on the minimum viable product initially. There's already a ton of custom technology. We really couldn't afford to have one more thing to shrink and commercialize. But we are going to bring that haptic feedback back in the near future. The thermal feedback back in the near future. But to your point, yes. So essentially, we very precisely control the pressure of air in each of those channels. And we have a novel valve architecture we've developed that has a 12-bit closed loop control over each of those channels. So we have, you know, over 1,000 different pressure states that we can control for each of those actuators. Wow. And that allows us to very precisely set essentially the height and the pressure of each of those actuators. And, you know, obviously there's a spatial component as well. You know, there's over 100 of these across the hand. And so you can imagine, you know, pretty quickly how, you know, essentially we could create a shape in this array that deforms your skin the same way a real shape would. For example, if you have a sphere in your palm in our glove, what we're literally doing is we're effectively inflating the actuators so that they make a sphere shape that deforms your hand in the same way. And that's why the glove feels so realistic, is because unlike something like electrical stimulation or vibration feedback, where it's fundamentally symbolic, you have a vibration or a shock that's substituting for a real sensation, In our case, we are actually recreating that real sensation in a very high fidelity manner.
Mm-hmm. So maybe one question that is, I would say it's appropriate, but why do you have so thick cables going to the gloves? Is it necessarily to get all the air and all the fluids in? Is it something that can be reduced in future? Because I think that's something that most of the people who see, you know, the photos and the amazing videos where you actually show the cases, when they see for the first time, like, those are a lot of cables going to the hand. So is it something that is due to the minimal viable product state, or is it how it is going to be?
Yeah, so in our current development kit, you know, it's a minimum viable product in terms of feature set. So, you know, we designed this development kit to have the feature set that our customers have indicated they need for this product to be useful. However, we do expect, you know, significant additional improvements in things like form factor, ergonomics, and so on and so forth before we ship our production version. So we would expect that cable to get significantly thinner. It's certainly not going to disappear, and it will probably still be a little bit thicker than the sort of electronic cable you'd see going to a Vive headset. But right now, most of the thickness of that cable is accounted for from inefficiencies in the manufacturing process. Right now, it's essentially a bundle of individual tubes that we're just buying off the shelf. And we plan to, without going into too much detail, we plan to essentially custom mold arrays of tubes in the future that will make that cable a lot more compact. So that's really more of an optimization that should significantly reduce the size of the cable.
And I think for the use cases that you're building towards, it seems like it's obviously mostly geared towards enterprise, and it's geared towards clients that are using this at a workstation, right? They have a computer, they have a headset, and they have the haptics kit and slipping their hands into it and then working at their desk, perhaps working on their design. Or what have you been seeing? Who have been the clients that have been the most interested and excited about the addition of like very accurate tactile feedback in VR?
Sure. So as you pointed out, we're absolutely targeting the enterprise market. You know, this is not a consumer product right now. It's something, you know, where we hope to eventually bring this level of feedback to the consumer market. But right now, we're very focused on high-end enterprise applications.
Yeah.
Most of our customers are concentrated in aerospace, automotive, government, industrial, and medical industries. So we're very much, you know, targeting high-end enterprise applications. And you know, the use cases in those markets tend to fall into three different categories. One is product design. So you know, right now, if you're designing, for example, a car, there tend to be a lot of very expensive, time-consuming physical prototyping steps to get a good idea of the tactile experience. Things like user experience, ergonomics, the feel of different controls and surfaces inside of an automobile. And that's something where one design revision can take weeks or months and cost hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars. And with haptics, you can dramatically shorten those design cycles where you can actually visualize, you know, not just visualize, but actually touch and interact with the interior of an automobile under design in VR. And that's something that can radically reduce costs and lead to a better product. And of course, those advantages apply also to an airplane interior or to any other sort of industrial machinery or industrial products you might imagine. So that's a big area of focus for us there. And then also training. Training is probably our largest application area right now. We have customers across the government sector, medical, industrial, and actually as well, automotive and aerospace, who are using our gloves to do high-end sort of VR training. So right now, again, same issue. You know, right now you can train in VR and you get good audiovisual immersion, but you don't get to engage your hands. You don't get that transfer of motor skills. And so much of, you know, of our memory for tasks we perform with our hands is tied to our motor skills, not to what we see and hear. So, you know, haptic feedback can dramatically improve the quality of that training, which is why right now, even though you can, you know, you have a perfectly adequate VR-based or video-based aircraft simulator, you know, the military and commercial aviation companies are still shelling out tens of millions of dollars for fully immersive, you know, full cockpit flight simulators where you have physical replicas of all of the controls. So for those high-end training use cases, our gloves provide a happy medium. They can provide much of the fidelity and the motor skills transfer of either live training or a traditional physical simulator at more of the cost and agility that's more similar to, and flexibility that's more similar to traditional VR. So that's something that potentially, again, can radically reduce the cost and increase the effectiveness of these training tasks. And then lastly is telerobotics. We're engaged in a very exciting project right now. And this one I actually can talk about in a little more detail because it's been, at least some details have been disclosed publicly. We were selected to provide haptics for the Avatar X consortium, which involves ANA, the large Japanese airline, the Japanese Space Agency, SoftBank, and a bunch of other companies, where the goal really is to build a next generation telerobotic system where you essentially can possess a robot. You move your hand, it moves its hand. You see what it sees. You feel what it feels. And that has profound implications for medical, industrial, military applications and more. Unfortunately, I can't talk about the details, but we've had some very exciting initial results integrating our gloves with cutting-edge robot arms, robot hands, robotic sensors and skin to really create a system where you can intuitively control a robot and feel what it feels.
I think that so telerobotics has been something that we have been excited about for quite some time because it makes a lot of sense. I was having a conversation recently with a robotics researcher that was talking about how obviously with automation, like we are able to do a lot of things through automated like robots and perhaps even using machine learning to understand and do those tasks better. But there's always that 5% of the time where you just can't automate that task, even if it's you're automating the rest of the task. 95% of it is figured out, but there's always still a lot that there's still that margin that you still cannot automate. And so this researcher was thinking about using VR as a way of having a person sitting kind of as a telephone operator would in the 50s, right? Someone sitting and manning 100 robots. And every time a robot needs human help, they're already in their gloves and or in a headset and they beam into that robot and they help them kind of figure out exactly what needs to be done. And I really thought that was a brilliant kind of this image, this scene of like how VR can help humans and robots work together better and help complete these like really intricate tasks that cannot really be automated yet. Is that something that you envision as well, or is this kind of
that's absolutely where I think it's going, and that's really what this consortium, the vision this consortium is built around, is a fusion of human intelligence with robotic bodies. And I think you threw out the number 95%. I think that's a very, very generous assessment of, what robots and AI can accomplish right now. I would, venture to say it's more like 5%. Look at all of the dexterous human tasks that would be performed in, say, a medical environment or a military environment or oil and gas, energy. In most cases, we're still relying on live human workers. And where robots are used, they tend to be pretty simple, repetitive tasks. And certainly AI is advancing rapidly, but I'm not hopeful that even in the next 20 years, AI will get to the point where it can replace the motor intelligence and decision-making skills of humans. And frankly, for some of those critical tasks, like, for example, surgery or a soldier deciding when to fire a weapon or something along those lines, where you really do want a human in the loop, I'm not sure that we want them to. I think there are some profound advantages to fusing a human with a robot. You get, a human's motor intelligence, ability to handle objects, use their body with, a robot's body, which is, frankly, more disposable. If you're working in hazardous environments like a nuclear reactor or a battlefield or, an oil refinery or something along those lines, and, potentially can multiply the capabilities of humans many times, greater strength, greater speed, whatever advantages it may be.
There is also another possibility where you actually not only allow humans to control robots, but you actually improve the human-robot interaction. So in a sense, it's also about, training people how to be safe around robots, training robots through, telepresence. But it's, I think, also going to change the way how humans and robots interact together. Because in a sense, so far, most robots have been caged in those mass production facilities, and it would be very dangerous to come close to them. So they were definitely not trained or definitely not programmed, and it was very hard to detect when a human was around, so they could, you know, harm them. But I think with technologies that are coming around with augmented and virtual reality and them being used to train robots but also interact with them, you could imagine that it's at some point you can feel what a robot feels in terms of, you know, when he touches the surface, and the robot can in the same sense also kind of interpret your movements, you know, and interpret your gestures and your intentions.
And so much of that comes down to touch and motor intelligence. It's a proprioceptive sense, yep, you know, kinesthetic sense of awareness of where your body is in space and relative to other things, and then a sense of the amount of pressure and force you're applying to the environment. You know, particularly when you're talking about dexterous skills, things that we're doing with our hands. You know, that's a lot of the places where where robots haven't been able to replace human workers does involve motor intelligence. Human brain is still by far the most powerful processor for, you know, for motor interactions, physical interactions. And again, I don't think AI is going to catch up anytime soon. You know, the human intuition and ability to use our bodies in space, interact with objects, is unparalleled.
Yeah.
And the beauty of haptics is you automatically get, you know, you automatically solve the hardest problem. You know, of course, it's a hard enough problem in and of itself to provide an interface that allows humans to manipulate robots dynamically and, you know, and feel what they feel. Once you do that, you automatically get the artificial intelligence because you have a human brain that is taking the input from the robot and is automatically reacting to that input with the appropriate output. And so if you can get that that loop to be high fidelity enough and low latency enough, then you really will have a robot with the motor skills and intelligence of a human. And that's something that I think, you know, even as AI advances, will be enormously valuable for a wide array of applications. I just don't see any substitute for that in the near future, you know, with a totally untethered robot. I do believe, though, coming back to where this conversation started, I do think we'll see something like, you know, what you describe, where you have a single human that's controlling a variety of robots. You know, I think that would, you know, where you have artificial intelligence that's taking control of the robots and doing routine tasks, and then where they are doing something that requires that higher level of oversight or motor skills or intelligence, you do have a human that's hopping into that robot, taking it over, doing that task, and then moving on. And perhaps there's even some sort of you know, machine learning component where the robot is you know, watching what the human does, learning from that, and then is doing a better job next time on that same task. So the opportunities are just endless.
Absolutely. So maybe we could quickly also come back to the topic of haptics and just have a quick overview. What kind of crazy experiments, you know, different people actually did to achieve some kind of haptics simulations? For example, one thing that I saw in Laval was a cube which had different materials, and you would put actually a virtual reality headset on. And when you would touch something in this virtual car that you were sitting in, the cube, because it was mounted on an arm, would basically rotate and present you the right surface. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the automotive industry, it seems to be a very interesting thing, but it obviously had a big delay. I mean, you have those very complex machines like Haptions. It's also a French company that makes this very big robots.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Like an arm and another arm, and then you can kind of feel with it force feedback. So you can kind of mount parts in VR, and when you try to mount them, right, you cannot actually pass through this part because there's a robot blocks. So they also have, I think, a glove prototype, which is also very expensive. I mean, those devices are in general very expensive, but they kind of really rely on this, you know, we want to do this force feedback where you really can't push your hands through a solid object. Then you have obviously all the glove companies that tries vibrations, and you have this very small Haption-like device with this pen on it that I think dentists used to train to drill teeth and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think at IEEE VR, I saw also a talk where I think even I need to figure out the links. Like one researcher strapped to this standard pen, like this small device with a pen on it, which you can feel surfaces, some kind of vibromotor, and that scientifically shown improved the simulation of different materials. So when you actually combine different technologies that can, you know, do also some magic. So
yeah,
what would be the unique standing out features that your product provides? Because I see that, you can't have so far everything in one. You can't have like real touch. You can't have electrical stimulation. You can't have actually force feedback. that is not based on your muscle activity, but actually on, you know, something hitting your heart. So what makes your product really unique and allows to do something way better or uniquely that all the other products don't do?
Historically, haptics have fallen into two categories. You have general purpose devices, you know, like some of the gloves and suits that you mentioned, that allow you to do anything you want with your body, any environment, but typically provide, you know, relatively poor quality and fundamentally symbolic feedback, where it's not, you know, a realistic sensation. On the other hand, you have highly specialized devices that can provide extremely good feedback, you know, in some cases almost completely realistic feedback, but usually are constrained to a single interaction or a very narrow array of interactions. So for example, if you're doing a surgical simulation, you can mount a tool on a big robotic arm, and you can simulate the forces very accurately on that tool, or taking it to even more of an extreme, which is commonly right now what's used for what a lot of our customers use for training and design. You actually can just build a one-to-one physical replica of an environment. You can build, you know, mock-ups of all of the components and parts. And of course, that's the ultimate in highly specialized. It is literally a physical thing, but perfect fidelity or very close, because you're touching a physical object. So what we saw is there's a huge demand for something that is kind of the best of both worlds, for a device that is fully general purpose, so you can interact with anything in an environment that's software defined, not limited to props or specialized pieces of hardware, and you have a fidelity that is comparable to those more complex special purpose devices. So, you know, we consider our system to be by far the highest fidelity among those general purpose systems. And sure, it's not going to be quite as good as having a physical replica of something, but it's orders of magnitude less expensive and much, much, much more flexible. You can train many, many different things, for example, many different tasks with a single system just by switching out software. Whereas right now, you're limited severely by the special purpose nature of that hardware. You have to build very expensive piece of hardware for every single one of those tasks. So, you know, that's really where we focused, is trying to come up with a very high fidelity general purpose device. And, you know, really to hit every one of those key modes of feedback. Ours is the only device that can provide high fidelity tactile feedback, force feedback, vibration feedback, and even, as you saw, thermal feedback, although that's not integrated into our current product, it'll be back in our products in the near future. So, you know, we really think of ourselves as the highest fidelity and only truly multimodal general purpose device. And as our system evolves, I do think in the near future we'll get to the point where we can match the fidelity of those special purpose simulators or props with something that is orders of magnitude more flexible. And the way, you know, looking more, it's kind of an abstract answer, but speaking more practically about, you know, how our customers are using this, you know, right now, for example, when we work with aerospace companies, we're not expecting to replace a $50 million flight simulator overnight. You know, this is something that they've invested billions and billions of dollars over years and years. But we're finding with these customers, if we can reduce the amount of time they have to spend training on these systems by just, you know, 20, 30%, you know, 40, 50%, something along those lines, we're saving them billions and billions of dollars, and we're getting, you know, orders of magnitude more repetitions in a more relevant training environment for the target user. And that's priceless to these companies. Or to give you another example, you know, one of our customers in the industrial sector makes equipment that literally costs close to $100 million. And right now, when they make and ship that equipment, they have to save usually between 10 and 20 of those units to do training, to train their maintenance workers, to show their customers. And, you know, if we can replace just a fraction of those physical units with, haptics-based VR training, we can save them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, that's kind of where we're starting, is we're not trying to replace, live training or traditional, you know, very expensive specialized simulators overnight, but we are displacing a significant enough fraction of, those tasks to, save tons of money for these companies and open up lots of new training opportunities. And then over time, as our system improves, we'll replace more and more of that to the point where, you know, we are the haptic platform. We're a general purpose platform that can be used for any training task. And, you know, we're not that far away from that, I don't think. If you look at, you know, the quality of simulation we can produce right now. And the content library we're already starting to build up with our customers for all of these different applications.
What's the key to your success? Because honestly, as there are a lot of companies out there that try to do force feedback exoskeleton for the hand and they somehow fail, there are a lot of companies like Vanus VR that kind of brought a product out or are offering it, but still their hand tracking is not as precise as you would expect to be good enough to actually do haptic simulation. And I see you use some kind of magnetic motion tracking, which I assume is also something that not many companies use. And obviously you have also the microfluidic skin. So you have like a lot of very novel technology combined. And how do you manage it? Because, I mean, a lot of hardware companies struggle. I mean, we see every day, Kickstarter projects not being delivered or VR companies, giving up. And you seem to have like an array of novel technologies. And it's not just one, it's not just two. It's like, I guess, multiple things that you have to build on your own and kind of strap together out of, off the shelf parts. But still, it seems like a pretty complex product, which is still very impressive as critics. But I mean, how do you manage to actually, build those things and ship them out where other companies actually fail at only one of those,
Yeah, so it's obviously a complex question. I guess I'll break it into a couple of pieces. So, first of all, I would note, I think that is probably the biggest secret to our success is that we have actually managed to build a bunch of new novel technologies and integrate them into a functional product. Because, haptics, and this is why I was drawn to the field in the first place, has a lot of unsolved basic, science and engineering problems. And they're just... there aren't off-the-shelf technologies out there right now that that have the fidelity and the other specifications needed to build a viable haptic product. And I think a lot of other companies out there, whether because of constraints in funding or because of targeting a very aggressive price point or the consumer market, are restricted to basically repurposing technology that's already out there, and in many cases has been for 30 years, like the sort of vibration gloves that you talked about or motion tracking gloves that use bend sensors. So those kind of technologies have been out there for a long time, and they haven't been widely adopted because, frankly, they suffer from a lot of deficiencies. So we came at this from the beginning as an R&D project. We knew we had to develop these core technologies and prove them out before we built a product. And so we spent 4 years before we even began to commercialize the gloves, just focusing on developing and proving out the core technology. And I think one of the reasons we had the luxury of doing that is, we've cultivated a large and very supportive group of investors and shareholders, customers. We have a wonderful network of partners across the board, and they've been unusually supportive and patient as we've done this basic research, built proof of concepts of the technology, and really just now gotten to the point where we have a commercially viable product. And that is very unusual. And I'm very thankful to those partners and investors that they've had the patience and seen the potential to put a large amount of money and have a lot of patience in this company as we've developed all those new technologies. I would also say our team is a big factor. We have almost 40 people on our team, so we're a fairly sizable team. Almost all of them are engineers. And we do have a highly multidisciplinary team. So, we don't just have engineers concentrated in one specialty. We have mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, software engineers, biomedical engineers, mechatronic engineers, pretty much every discipline represented. And I think that's been a key factor in our success as well, because so many of the problems that we're tackling are fundamentally multidisciplinary. And when you're building something like our glove, you have all of these different core technologies. We have pneumatics and electromagnetics, you have these complex mechanical engineering problems, these ergonomics and human factors problems that are very unique. You just can't solve those problems with engineers from a single discipline. And I think so often, as compelling as much of the academic research in haptics tends to be, I think so often people get siloed in a single area. And so they build a very precise, very advanced device that's very narrow in scope. And they don't, tackle as many of these cross-disciplinary and cross-paradigmatic problems. And then lastly, I would say another, another reason we've been successful is we've been very, very focused. I think a lot of the other haptics companies out there have sort of tried to have it both ways, saying, hey, we're going to ride the wave of consumer VR and pretend we're a consumer product, but at the same time, we're going to try and go after the enterprise market. and you end up with something that is too expensive for the consumer market and not nearly high performance enough from the enterprise market. You know, from the very beginning, we've made no bones about the fact that this is an expensive product. This is not appropriate for the consumer market. It's very complex. You know, it's relatively early in its development cycle, and it's highly targeted at high-end enterprise applications. And, you know, we're going to start there by making sure those customers' needs are met before we try and go into the consumer market. And as a result, you know, I know some people look at our device and say, you know, holy cow, that's so big, it's so expensive, it's so complex. But you know what? It works really well. And it,
exactly.
It, you know, more importantly, it works really well for the it's been designed specifically for the applications our customers care about and are willing to pay for. You know, we are right now and will be for the foreseeable future very focused on high-end enterprise. And I think ultimately that will serve as a laboratory that allows us to continue building and refining this technology and developing new technology until we actually do have something that is high enough volume, low enough cost, and high enough fidelity that it can be brought to the consumer market, probably initially through location-based entertainment and then maybe one day actually consumer in-home. But we certainly didn't start there.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty easy mistake to make to try to build, you know, the Ready Player One gloves for people that want to be in Ready Player One worlds and feel and interact with people around them. I think since all the fiction and all the that backstory is there that we all want, but it's easy to fall into that thinking where, oh, I will make a peripheral device for a consumer device that already has such a small market now. You know, it's like, We've seen too many haptic VR glove things come through and fail that just, I think, didn't think through the strategy. And I think you said it perfectly, where you're building something that's too expensive to consumer, but actually too cheap and not specialized enough for enterprise, where there's you have no market, essentially.
Exactly. You really have to choose one or the other. And you know, we realized, and by the way, we didn't start here. You know, early on, we didn't have that focus for market strategy. We went out, we looked at the market, we talked to, you know, some of the top investors in the space, we talked, more importantly, to our customers, and we figured out pretty quickly, you know, the only place there's really a market here, and particularly a market for technologies as new and complex as what we want to build and what we've been building, is in the enterprise market. And we zeroed in pretty quickly on you know, automotive, aerospace, medical, industrial, and government, and on these three use cases: the design, training, and telerobotics. And you know, that's where we're going to stay for right. the near future.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense given where we are with VR. And I think even on this podcast, over the last year and a half, we've really focused a lot more on enterprise and understood really where these use cases make a lot of sense. And for enterprise, everything comes down to the bottom line. You know, can you save money by doing it this method rather than the other? And turns out training is probably, again, one of the biggest factors. Even last week, we had someone from the UK, from the company called River, where they're working with firefighters and building very realistic simulation trainings that is cheaper, repeatable, and more robust than being able to actually burn down, you know, fake house and try to have people go through and learn that way. So training is like something, is a theme that keeps coming up over and over again in our episodes and will be continue to do so over the future. I have one.
I was just going to say there's so many wonderful, just a quick plug for, you know, enterprise VR. There's so many wonderful companies, you know, many of whom, you know, we're working with in one capacity or another that are targeting the same market. So, you know, we're far from the only company that's adopting this strategy. I think a lot of the most successful VR companies today are going after the enterprise market, and often they're going very, you know, specifically after something like training or design, and, you know, and they're specializing. And I would say for, you know, for anyone who's in the process of starting a new VR company, I wholeheartedly believe in the potential of consumer VR. You know, I am 100% confident that one day we will get to the point of Ready Player One where you have high-end consumer VR that's widespread, but we're just not there yet. And as a startup, the economics of the consumer market are impossible right now. You know, you look at a company like Oculus, for example, that has, you know, tons and tons of resources, you know, thousands of times more than most startups have. And you know, even for them, they're still saying, if you heard Michael Abrash talking at, you know, Oculus Connect, they're saying that consumer haptic gloves are 10 years out. And I think, you know, that's probably about right. I think it might be a little quicker than that. But, you know, I think Michael Abrash is right. You know, the level of performance at the price point and volumes you need, not to mention the content ecosystem, adoption issues.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brutal. Even for a company Facebook size, the economics of shipping a consumer hardware device that has to have a broad content ecosystem are just brutal. And I don't see, you know, in the near future, a reasonable way for a startup to do that. Look at another one's Magic Leap. You know, they've you know, raised almost $2 billion now. And, you know, even with that level of obscene funding, you know, there are questions about whether they're going to be able to succeed in bringing their device to the consumer market, because it's so complex, it's so expensive and so time consuming to, you know, ship a volume hardware device and build an ecosystem for the consumer market. So
absolutely.
And all that's not to say I don't believe in the potential of consumer VR. Again, I'm the, you know, the biggest fan in the world. It's been my dream almost my entire life. But I just think the community has to be realistic in seeing that that's not where the, you know, that's not where the use cases are. That's not where the money is right now. That's not where you can build a business. Start with enterprise, meet the needs, you know, pick a couple of customers and solve their problems. And you know, that's how you build a business right now in VR, and then take what you're learning there. And if you want to go to the consumer market, you know, go to the consumer market, but don't start there.
Yeah. There's no question that consumer VR is here and it is here to stay, even with the small numbers, you know, of users that there are. The numbers that Steam has released, or Valve has released about Steam VR is just promising. There's clearly, this is the start of a kind of an exponential growth, and we're at that still that very low rate, you know, the beginning. You know, we haven't hit that we're not at the stride yet to really be growing. But there's people that are naysayers about consumer VR, I think, just don't understand how to look at the numbers and understand, like, even with all the ergonomics problems that exist with VR today, people are willing to put up with that because the experience is worth it. And there's still a very steady stream of content that is being built and being even more polished every month that things are coming out. And so, we're both huge fans of it. And we talk, you know, we even have sometimes game designers that come on to talk about, you know, the interesting design choices and the problems that they have to tackle to create a good consumer product. So no question about that. But I think the question in terms of haptics for consumer is what do you really need, and how much of it can you get away with by having some form of finger tracking on the controller, and how much can you get away with some, you know, simple form of tactile feedback with like vibration motors instead of a controller?
Let me share my perspective on that. Yeah. So I think, you know, again, I think that the big guys right now, like, you know, Oculus and HTC, Microsoft, I mean, I think they're taking the right approach. I think we'll see, you know, we'll see a gap in consumer VR. There's no doubt in my mind we'll eventually see consumer haptic gloves. But in the short term, I think markerless tracking makes a lot more sense. Having a front mounted camera or something like a Leap Motion on a VR headset. You know, motion tracking alone with the hands is already an improvement. It's not, you know, it's not nearly as good as having full haptic immersion. And you know, it's not appropriate for most enterprise applications, but for consumers, hand tracking is already a big improvement over controllers. And I do think that the computer vision problems, as complex as they are, around, you know, capturing accurate hand poses are being solved. And the technology is cheap enough to come to the consumer market. It's already available in some forms and will be available in a mature form very soon. So my prediction is we will see widespread hand presence in consumer VR very soon through things like markerless optical tracking and you know, next generation controllers like the Knuckles controller that has some level of finger tracking built in. And I think, unfortunately, that's probably the way it will stay for the next couple of years. You know, there's a reason, you know, Mike Labrador is a very smart guy. There's a reason he's standing up on stage and saying that, you know, I'm predicting that we will have consumer haptics. And by the way, I think he said something to the effect of, you know, it will be as powerful or as, you know, revolutionary as the first time you try a VR headset when you try good haptic gloves. But, you know, it's 10 years away. And I think that's probably about right. There is no technology, you know, take it from me, I wish there was, would make our job a lot easier, but there is no technology right now that can deliver high enough fidelity haptics to be worth a consumer putting on gloves at a price point that is appropriate for the consumer market, you know, a couple hundred bucks at most, and in high volumes. It just doesn't exist. And it's not really even that close, frankly. I mean, I hate to disappoint people, but you know, I think we will eventually see things like microfluidic technology in the consumer market. It is physically possible, but the amount of work that has to be done to miniaturize our technology down to the point where it is appropriate for the consumer market is significant. And, you know, I don't see a lot of other alternatives. I think without, sure, you can, there's some simple force feedback gloves out there on the market, you know, the VR glove and Dexta and that kind of thing.
Sure.
There's plenty of vibration gloves, but I don't think they provide a compelling enough increase in the fidelity of the experience over motion tracking alone to be worth the added cost and complexity. And in some cases, what we're hearing often from customers, which I think applies to the consumer market alone, is they can be worse than tracking alone, both because of the challenges of putting them on and, you know, the weight on your arms and so on and so forth. But perhaps less obviously, because of what we call the haptic uncanny valley. So as I talked about earlier, just like your brain expects, you know, human faces to have a certain set of characteristics, and if they don't have that, unconsciously you find it very uncanny and disturbing. The same thing happens with haptics. When you grab an object, you expect to feel tactile stimulation, displacement of the skin, in concert with force feedback on your fingers, and if it's heavy enough, forces on your arm. And if you don't synchronize the force feedback, the tactile feedback, and have the very, very precise motion tracking you need to drive those things, you get a very uncanny sensation, and you get negative transfer of motor skills into the real world. It's uncanny, it's confusing, and you're not able to use your hands the way that your brain thinks you should. So I think that's a major problem.
Is there any science on that? Because for me, like, the uncanny valley term is something that plays in VR a big role. So there is obviously the visual uncanny valley, right? I mean, you can see a face. But there is also at least few papers that I found on the interaction uncanny valley where scientists are trying to figure out, you know, when the interaction just doesn't feel right. It's not so much about the haptics, but more like how you interact with an object and your performance in certain tasks drops. Are you maybe aware of any research that suggests that there is a haptics uncanny valley and it has an effect? Because I would love to read that.
Yeah, it's mostly based on our own internal research. I could probably dig up some published papers. I have seen some papers that hit on pieces of this, but I don't know of a paper that covers it in the same level of detail that we've done internal testing. You know, internally, we've looked at you know, very in a lot of detail with a number of you know, of human test subjects. We've looked at various combinations of tactile force feedback, motion tracking, thermal feedback, different levels of resolution, displacement, and tactile feedback, and looked at the point at which, you know, there is a subjective, there's a significant subjective drop in immersion and interaction capability. And that's what we've called the uncanny valley. So that's unfortunately something I can't share because it's proprietary, but it's something, you know, if you try our gloves, I'd be happy to show you. You know, we do have some testing modes where you can basically turn off features. Like, you can turn off force feedback, you can turn off tactile, or you can artificially degrade the tactile sensation. And it is very, very obvious.
It's weird.
Like, once you try that, it's weird.
Yeah, it's
you know, why we made the choices we made. Did you get a chance to try that, Oz, when you were testing out the gloves?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We went through just different combinations of having certain feedback on and off, and especially after you're kind of acclimated to using, you know, the full fidelity of the glove, turning off a specific feature is like, at first you might not even be able to voice exactly what is wrong, and your brain is just like, something is wrong here. And then you realize like, oh, like, I'm not feeling haptics, or I'm not feeling the full force feedback. I guess an equivalent feeling is that comes to mind is, and it's like such a bad comparison, but it gets the points across. If you use one of the latest iPhones, you know, in the last like 3 years, if you use Twitter on your iPhone, every time you like something, every time you heart something, you actually have a tactile feedback that happens in the phone. You feel your phone vibrate. It's probably like, you know, 1 or 2 hertz or something, but like, it's enough that you feel like you did something. And sometimes the Twitter app bugs out and it doesn't give you that feedback. And it is probably one of the most unsatisfactory things to like a tweet and not feel that. I swear to God, like, it's like, you feel like, I didn't leave my mark on that tweet, or like, I didn't, you know, that was so unsatisfactory. And I think it's because we train ourselves with these very simple inputs to reinforce that form of like, behavior, and when you turn that off, it really does play with your,
I think that's a good analogy, you know, in a lot of ways, because, you know, think about it. Think about how many times you use your hands in a day to interact with objects, hundreds typically. Every time you do that, you're training your brain what to expect when you do something with your hands. That's how humans develop motor skills. And so in VR, when it doesn't have to be exact, but when you don't get over that bar of being close enough that your natural, you know, physical intuition and motor intuition translates, then that's when you hit that uncanny valley, because you're having to retrain yourself to use your hands differently. And that's not something anyone wants to do. And if you do do it, you know, there are plenty of studies on what's called negative training. You know, if you do have a trainer, and this is not just VR, this is really any training task. If you do have a trainer that is not close enough that you're over that bar, you are training incorrect motor skills and responses. So when you are in the real environment, not only do they not translate properly, but you get the wrong outcome. You know, you're doing the wrong thing, and it actually interferes with your brain's ability to process that task. So that's one of the big things our customers talk a lot about, you know, why they want our gloves, why they need haptics, you know, why they're still shelling out millions and millions of dollars for these massive traditional simulators is, you know, it's not acceptable not to have that motor engagement and motor skills transfer, because it can, in some of these applications, literally be life and death. You know, if you're training electrical line workers or soldiers or surgeons, you need to have that translation. And I think, you know, coming back to consumer VR, you know, there probably are more practical reasons why we're not going to see consumer gloves in the short term. I think the most important of which is the brutal, you know, absolutely vicious economics we talked about earlier that I think will preclude any of the startups out there building gloves right now from actually successfully introducing those for the consumer market, even if they were good enough. But, you know, based on, you know, my personal experience and all the people I've seen go through VR with haptics, all the time I've spent with the system, I do think that a lower level of haptic fidelity can in fact be worse than useless, because it does really mess with your natural motor skills. I think we are limited, coming back to the uncanny valley interaction. I think we are limited in the short term to being well on the other side of the valley, you know, using things like controller input or finger, you know, basic hand tracking input, where it is fundamentally symbolic. You are not expecting it to be identical to the way you interact with real object. And that's fine. You know, it's not perfect, but it's good enough that people can, you know, use VR and want to buy VR headsets and can have fun playing VR games. But I don't think there is an in-between. You know, vibration feedback, force feedback only, you're getting all of the disadvantages with, you know, without most of the advantages. So I think, you know, I think that unfortunately, Mike Labrash and others are wise, you know, to not try and introduce a mass market haptic product in the near term. And I think, unfortunately, you know, for reasons of human perception, technological limitations, and economic realities, other startups who target the consumer market will, with haptic peripherals will fail. And so I would encourage, anyone who's building a VR peripheral right now, again, to target the enterprise market. And use that as a proven ground for your technology, use it to build your business, because I just don't see a market right now for it in consumer, unfortunately.
Yeah. Makes sense. I have one burning question that I'll ask at the end, but Peter, go ahead with yours.
I have also one question that is burning since 20 minutes in my head, and I'm like, not sure, is it a stupid question or not, but what's with ferromagnetic liquids? So could you build something like, or could you build something similar to your glove, with basically fluids that react to magnetic or electric stimulation, and then instead of actually pumping air or liquids through the tubes, you just activate certain chambers with, like, you know, basically electric current or magnetism?
Short answer is no. Long answer is a little more complex. So the biggest area of research we focused on before we built the glove was, you know, tactile feedback arrays. And there is a very unique set of requirements for a tactile display that's going to be worn on the body. It needs to be light and thin. It needs to be high density. So you have to have a lot of actuators in a small space. It has to be high displacement. So it has to have very high levels of displacement relative to its thickness. And it has to be high bandwidth. So it has to be able to move quickly and be responsive. And there is no other actuator technology we found. And believe me, we looked at hundreds of different combinations of actuator technology, including ferrofluids, probably 20 different electromagnetic approaches. Just the physics of electromagnetics at that scale do not allow you to have that combination of features or anything close to it. To try and get the level of displacement And density of actuators with electromagnetics using ferrofluids or otherwise that we've achieved with pneumatics would require something that is rigid and, you know, many, many times the thickness and weight of what we've developed. You know, not to mention much higher power requirements, heat dissipation, everything else. So short answer is no. One other point on why we use air or gases rather than liquids, because of the size of our capillaries and the density of packing of the actuators, you just simply can't move liquid fast enough through those channels. The resistance is way, way too high on a liquid. So you wouldn't really get any movement of the fluid. The pressure drop is so significant that you would see a little tiny trickle of fluid. You'd have to apply a very high pressure. So micro hydraulic based displays do exist, but they're used for different applications. There was one company a while back that that built one that basically made a keyboard pop out of your phone, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But you'll notice that the actuation time is orders of magnitude longer. You know, our actuators have a bandwidth up to about 300 hertz. These actuators were a fraction of 1 hertz. You know, so it took, you know, a couple seconds for them to basically lift up and turn into a keyboard. And that's because of the
300 hertz.
Up to about 300 hertz. Now, we're not taking advantage of all of that bandwidth right now in software. So, you know, right now we're sort of trying to catch up to the capabilities of the hardware. But between the design and construction of the actuators themselves and the novel valve and manifold architecture that we've built, we actually can do vibration feedback up to about that 300 hertz level through the pneumatic channels themselves, which is pretty cool. That's not something that's really done before. And again, we're not fully taking advantage of that right now with our current product because we're trying to catch up on the software representation of textures and data transfer and everything. But within a couple of months, we would expect to have a software patch that introduces those very fine textures to our current development kit.
So, I mean, it's a final dream, basically putting on like a full body, I don't know, 3-4 centimeter thick suit, similar to one you would wear when you're in winter in Alaska or, you know, on the North Pole, and you just walk around. And while you walk around, you feel what some kind of robot distinct would feel. I mean, it sounds like it's totally doable, you know, in 20, 30 years to have like a whole body thing, right?
I don't think it'll be 20 or 30 years at all. And I don't think it'll be 2 or 3 centimeters. So right now, our skin material is about 1.5 millimeters thick. And it's only going to get thinner, not thicker. And it's actually much, much easier for us to build a bodysuit than it is for us to build gloves. If we wanted to, we could have a full bodysuit right now with the current technology.
Yeah, gloves might be the highest, you know, challenge you could take, right? Because you have like the most precision on your fingers.
You
like,
do. You have,
when you
have
look
about
like
a,
the human,
you have about 100 times higher tactile fidelity on your fingers than you do on your arms, your legs, your torso. And you have so many degrees of freedom in your fingers all packed closely together. So the finger, the hands are actually much, much more challenging than the rest of the body. We do have plans to introduce a bodysuit in the near future. And we do right now have the technology to do that. The limitation right now is just resources and focus. You know, we're focusing on getting our glove product to market first. And frankly, based on all the feedback we've seen from our customers, the gloves are a lot more useful than a full body suit. You know, people want, just like they want thermal feedback, they want a full body suit, but the vast majority of high value interactions with your environment come through your hands. They don't come through your chest or your legs or your feet. And so, you know, we want to build that bodysuit and make it convenient and affordable enough that customers can buy it as a nice to have, because it's really not required for most applications.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I have one final question that I've been thinking about, and it doesn't have to do as much with the actually tracking of the hand. But if you have such high fidelity output that's coming from your gloves, right? You said 12-bit actuators, and you have such high quality, high resolution input of your hands themselves. Can you use this as a, can you basically factor in neuroplasticity and use this as a interface between the user and the computer, so that, let's say you you're not really using it as gloves to grab things in virtual reality, but using all these actuators to actually train the user, different patterns, different sources of information that they can understand on a very low level, like intuitive level. We've talked a little bit about neuroplasticity, and by using like either your face or your hands as these very high resolution pads to be, pushing information to, and and basically understanding the different forms, different shapes of patterns. Is that something you guys have at all talked about or explored, or is that something that you want perhaps a developer to take on and explore and see what they can come up with?
Yeah, so I would say yes, that's certainly possible. I don't know that you would need anywhere near that level of fidelity to do that. So one of the important ways that we measure the fidelity of our gloves is the number of tactile states we can produce across the gloves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's we have 130 actuators times 12-bit proportional control per actuator. That's technically the level of control we have. But in reality, most of that gets thrown away as indistinguishable. Your brain can't distinguish anywhere near that level of fidelity, and practical effects like the glove moving around on your hand or change in temperature, so on and so forth, negate a lot of that level of fidelity. So, you know, we have far more information bandwidth in the glove than your brain could possibly process from tactile feedback in your hand. Which means that if you were designing a device for information transfer, which is fundamentally symbolic, right? You don't need something to feel realistic. You're trying to symbolize some sort of information. I would probably design a very different device. That being said, we probably have the only device that would be able to transfer the maximum amount of tactile information through the hand, whatever that is, because we so far exceed that threshold. So I'm sort of riffing here because this is not an area we focused on, but I would guess it would be relatively easy for someone to develop a coding system where you have, and it would actually be very interesting to see how much information, how many bits of information per second could actually be passed through the hand and have the brain still be able to distinguish it. So you'd have to develop a coding system, and then you would have to basically determine what your threshold for information transfer is above which, you know, you're losing data. And my guess is that wouldn't be pretty. It wouldn't be very high. Maybe tens of bits per second at most. Maybe probably more like bits per second. Who knows? But it's probably not very high.
I have also a last question. We are called Research VR because we love research, and this is where my question comes from. Is your glove system available for research institutions as well? So I could imagine my professor could actually, Professor Peter König could actually do great science with sensory motor integration and SOC SMCs with the gloves. But do you actually sell it or do cooperations with universities, or is it right now only the B2B hardcore customers?
Yeah, so right now we have a very limited supply of our development kits, and we are offering them on essentially a lease basis to customers. And because we have so much more demand than we have supply, which is something, by the way, we're working to change as quickly as we can. All of our efforts right now are focused on manufacturing scale up, so that hopefully won't last long. We really have to focus our resources on the highest priority customers. And so we love academic institutions. We have partnerships with a couple of them. We are actively pursuing a handful of research projects, but we're very limited right now in our ability to work with and offer equipment to academic institutions. So again, that hopefully will be short-lived. I would say certainly within the next year, we'll have far more availability of inventory at a lower price that we can offer to academic institutions. But for now, we're pretty limited in the number of customers we can work with, and we're really focusing on customers, major customers in our core industries that we have a close relationship with. So that, I don't want to discourage any academic institutions from reaching out to us. We actually are getting a couple a day right now from around the world that are saying, hey, I want to use your gloves for this project or this project. And as an engineering team, believe me, we would love nothing more than to have world-class researchers playing with our gloves and generating great data. But unfortunately, we just don't have enough gloves to go around right now. So please reach out, contact us. We'll be in touch and we'll let you know as soon as we have gloves available, which shouldn't be too long. But unfortunately, right now, they're not broadly available for academic institutions.
Fair enough. Jake, how can people find you and find out more about Haptics?
So best place is haptics.com. Got plenty of videos, descriptions of the technology and applications. There is an early access link if you're interested in getting your hands on the gloves. Please apply and we'll reach out to you. And then for me personally, I suppose you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm Jake Rubin.
Fantastic. And thank you all for listening again to the Research VR podcast. You can find us on Twitter at ResearchVRcast, and you can find our Patreon at patreon.com/The Wizard of Oz, that is under my name. Thank you again, Jake Rubin, for joining us today.
Thanks so much, guys, for having me. It's been a fun conversation.
Absolutely. And thank you all for listening. Goodbye.